At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu. At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
So far, things in the Brian Walsh trial have been going, well, I don't think as smoothly as Brian would want them to. Sergeant Harris and Schmidt took the stand and calmly dismantled every inch of the story Brian Walsh has been selling since day one. It wasn't routine. This was the kind of testimony that stripped varnish off of a narrative. This was the kind of testimony that takes the idea of reasonable doubt and sets it on the table and then walks a blowtorch right across it. Harrison Schmidt is not a flashy witness. He's not there to dramatize anything. He's not emotional. He's not editorializing. He's not trying to convince anyone of anything. He's a man who has done fatal investigations, missing person cases, SWAT work, search and rescue, and the kind of interagency coordination most departments only dream of. He's been doing this more than a decade. When Schmidt speaks, he doesn't speculate. He doesn't even need to. He just tells you what happened. And what he said in court in the trial of Brian Walsh told a story that piece by piece showed a husband spinning a narrative so convoluted, so bloated, so self-serving, it practically begs to collapse under its own weight. Let's start with the basics. Schmidt got called into this case on January 4th of 2023, the day Anna was first reported missing. And before anybody had worked up a theory, before any forensic testing, before any media frenzy, before anybody even knew this case was going to be what it is now, Schmidt walked into Brian Walsh's home. The house, the scene, the place where Anna supposedly kissed her husband goodbye, told him she loved him, and climbed into a mysterious taxi her young child just happened to hear but couldn't see, the place where the last moments of her documented life allegedly unfolded. Schmidt sits at the dining room table with Brian, the first real interview, and from that moment on, the walls of this so-called narrative start shaking. Because where most husbands in this situation offer panic or clarity or something resembling a linear recounting of the last time they saw their wife, Brian offers everything but that. Everything except a straightforward account of anything. Instead, he invites these investigators into his personal storytelling universe, where SIM cards break and JetBlue points need to be earned and Uber accounts migrate across systems and bosses named Jim come over for New Year's dinners and his children are conducting side missions with iPads and phone passwords and he can't find his phone because the nanny had it, because the child took it, because someone set it down somewhere, because you realize quickly he's not just telling a story. He's trying to bury the actual story underneath 30 others. But here's where Schmidt becomes the quiet wrecking ball. He never reacts to the nonsense. He just documents it. He testifies to it calmly, clinically. And the more he recounts, the worse the picture becomes. Because Schmidt is not interpreting behavior or offering opinions. He's simply telling the jury, this is what the defendant said and did when his wife was missing. And it sounds nothing like a man searching for a loved one. It sounds like a man managing a situation. Let's walk through what he actually observed that day, because this is where the outline becomes a roadmap straight into the contradictions. Schmidt arrives at the house. The kids are at the kitchen island eating McDonald's. Okay, fine. Life does not stop because tragedy knocks. But the lack of urgency radiating through that home is striking. No chaos, no frantic husband, no searching, no tear-streaked panic. Just a man ready to tell a story, a long story. And an officer ready to hear it. Brian sits down. Schmidt asks him to start at the beginning. And from there, we get the now infamous timeline in which Anna supposedly leaves for a work emergency on a night her employer says nothing required her presence. From a house, the child says she left by taxi, even though no taxi ever touched that property. And on a morning, Brian apparently slept through everything, except when he didn't. Depending on which sentence you catch him in. Even Schmidt's body language, as described in court, tells you he was investigating and navigating a maze. Then comes the walkthrough. And this is where the evidence, the silence, and the absence of normal things speak louder than Brian's marathon monologue ever could. Schmidt walks through the home. The jury sees the photos, 52 of them, admitted into evidence. No objections, no spin. These aren't dramatized reenactments. They are the raw virtual record of that night. And what you see through Schmidt's testimony is haunting, not because something violent leaps out, but because the normal indicators of a wife leaving the home simply do not exist. Let's state that plainly. When Anna Walsh supposedly left her house at dawn to catch an emergency flight, she left behind things that contradicted the idea that she'd left willingly. Things Schmidt documented meticulously. Her glasses, still in the house. If she needed them, she didn't take them. She didn't need them, fine. But the fact that she didn't take a single backup set and left them sitting casually in the primary living space is not what most people do when traveling for an emergency work assignment. Her children's behavior doesn't align with an actual goodbye. Kids may be unreliable narrators, but they're very reliable observers of emotional tone. A child recalling a simple, "I love you," could be profound or it could be implanted by context, but Schmidt's neutral presentation of it lets the absurdity of the moment breathe. Brian tries to lean heavily on the child's memory of a taxi, while Schmidt simply tells the jury no taxi was ever recorded, called, or confirmed by any service in the entire region. The house itself, the layout, the rooms, the flow matters because Schmidt is walking the jury through a physical environment that stands in direct opposition to Brian's story. The side door Brian says Anna left through, no signs of exit. The security footage from the camera she supposedly used, because that footage was on her phone. The same phone we're told was left at home except when it wasn't, except when it supposedly traveled, except when it didn't. Then we reach the basement. Schmidt notes the door with the child safety latch, the stairs, the utility space, the refrigerator, the boxes, the bags, and in those bags, he notes without drama, the presence of a carpet sample or piece of rug. He doesn't embellish. He doesn't theorize. He just tells the jury that in a missing person case, a rug stuffed into a trash bag in the basement, it raises some eyebrows. Not because rugs are illegal, but because rugs are often removed when they contain something someone doesn't want the world to see. Then comes the pool. The first night they were there, the water was dark green, cloudy, unreasonably warm out. No ice, no cover. It was an active question. Could she be in there? So what do? They come back with the fire department that night, with floodlights and equipment. They scrape the pool. They drag it with a skimmer. They turn that backyard into a search zone, and they find nothing. But they look because they had reason to look, reason that didn't come from thin air. All of this, all of it, is happening while Brian is giving them endless, winding backstories about SIM cards, JetBlue points, flight credits, his mother's medical issues, the nanny's availability, how sick everyone has been, how tired Anna was, how hard she worked, how he cooked French toast, how he cleaned up, how he lost his phone, how he didn't lose his phone, how it died, how it got taken, how the nanny had it, how the kids had it, how he had it, but not enough to call his missing wife. Schmidt never says this was suspicious. He doesn't need to. It's already screaming off the page. But the Volvo, that's where the line between strange and what we are even looking at here becomes impossible to ignore. Inside the trunk of the Volvo, Schmidt finds plastic sheeting folded, purposely placed, not random grocery bags, not leftover packaging. Plastic sheeting, the kind you line things with, the kind you put down when you expect a mess. Again, Schmidt doesn't editorialize. He just says what he saw. He also sees a maple seedling because in cases like this, nature itself, it turns witness. But it gets worse. In Brian's second interview, January 5th, things get even more unhinged. Not because Brian is acting crazier, but because Schmidt's recounting exposes how quickly Brian loses control of the story when confronted a second time. Suddenly the timelines shift. Suddenly the details about when he had his phone and where he went morph like clay under heat. Suddenly his errands expand and shrink. Suddenly his mother needs more, then less, then different care. Suddenly his feelings about Anna's job shift from concern to admiration, to resentment, to confusion. What you realize listening to Schmidt tell it is that the consistency of Brian's story depends entirely on whether he's telling it in real time or remembering the version he told earlier, and the versions don't match. Schmidt also notes, again, without flourish, that Brian asked whether he should get a PR person. Not because he wanted to help find his wife, because he wanted to manage optics. That's not a grieving husband. That's not a panicked spouse. This is someone in the crisis of a very different kind of his own making. And he's stupid enough to ask the investigator, should I get a PR person? I got a nice Warhol over here if you want to buy it. No, he didn't offer him to buy a Warhol, but I'm sure that might have been, you know, somewhere on that repertoire of crazy that came out of his mouth. And then comes the digital angle. Schmidt notes that the devices were taken on consent. On consent, meaning Brian allowed it, but with hesitation, with explanations, with the same endless context he used to pump air into the rest of his story. But Brian also wanted to check with Anna's friends first, because apparently when your wife vanishes into thin air, the thing you worry about most is whether her coworkers think it's okay for investigators to look at your phone. Schmidt presents this neutrality. The jury hears it not as this man was uncooperative, but this man was concerned about something that had nothing to do with finding his missing wife. Then the attic with the hole in the ceiling below it, the attic Schmidt didn't enter the first night, but did on the second. Unfinished, insulation, exposed joists, nothing of note. But here's the point. Investigators looked everywhere. Schmidt doesn't make assumptions. He follows leads. He follows access points, escape routes, storage areas. He clears spaces. He checks for anything that shouldn't be there and makes it down, marks it down when he finds something that is. Schmidt's testimony also walks the jury into the woods, literally the wooded area behind the home, the path to the next neighborhood, the space a quarter mile away that could theoretically conceal movement. He brings him through canine searches, rideshare checks, cab company calls, airport scams, Amtrak inquiries, fusion center alerts, bulletins, canvassing troopers, detectives, the full machinery of a missing person investigation. And what do all of these systems return? Nothing. No travel, no trace, no departure, no witness, no signing, no confirmation that Anna left the house alive. Meanwhile, Schmidt is just telling you what he saw. And what he saw was a man offering everything except the thing investigators needed. Truth. A man who gave detail after detail, yet none of it anchored to verifiable events. A man who provided narrative, not evidence. A man who felt the edges of the real story closing in and kept expanding the fictional one to make room. Every contradiction in Brian's own statements becomes sharper when Schmidt lays them out without emotion. You hear how Brian's voice shifts, how the details about the taxi don't survive even the most basic scrutiny, how the timeline from New Year's Eve to January 1st morphs three different ways in three different tellings, how the errands multiply thin, how the trip to his mother's becomes a feature-length film, and how missing phones become a funhouse mirror, how the supposedly overworked wife who loved her kids, cared for her family, and thought ahead suddenly leaves without the very items that allowed her to function daily. And the biggest contradiction of all, The woman he describes, dedicated, meticulous, structured, tethered to her responsibilities, does not just walk out of a house without her phone, without her glasses, without her ID, without a bag, without notice, without communication, without a single digital footprint. That woman does not evaporate. But Schmidt doesn't need to say that. He just hands you the map. And when you look at the map, the destination is unmistakable. Nothing Brian said matches the physical reality Schmidt documented. And this is why his testimony mattered. Not because it solved the case, not because it introduced a smoking gun, but because it showed the jury something far more damning. A story that only works when you don't look at any part of it directly. A story that survives only in the fog of Brian's own narration. A story that wilts instantly under the steady clinical light of someone like Schmidt, someone trained to see what's there and what's missing. That is what actually happened. A quiet dismantling of a loud story. A calm exposure of a frantic man's attempt to outrun the truth by burying investigators in details he hoped would create enough static to cover the silence. But silence doesn't lie. Evidence doesn't lie. Timelines don't lie. And Sergeant Harrison Schmidt didn't lie either. He didn't need to. He just told the truth plainly and lets the weight of the truth fall exactly where it belongs. It was damning testimony. Curious to get your thoughts. Is that enough just to sink him right there, just with the lead investigator coming in and saying all that? Obviously, this is a case where it seems pretty black and white, but as we know, no case truly ever is. Is there any room where Brian's version of events speak to just one juror enough to make them believe his tall tales? It's a good question. Obviously, Brian Walsh is innocent until proven guilty. We'll keep watching this. We'll keep reporting on it. You keep giving us your thoughts in the comments there on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Hit subscribe while you're there. We're trying to get to 100,000 subscribers by the end of the year. We might make it. I don't know. Maybe with your help, if you hit subscribe right now. If you're listening to us on the podcast platforms, hit subscribe there too so you don't miss any of our coverage. My name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores. You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.